You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes. Welcome back to the Best Practices Show. My name is Kirk Barron. I'm your host, and we are on a string, a series, a step-by-step process of figuring out. No, I love this guy. You're going to see.
I wish you could get a lot more excited. That's for sure. I wish you could get excited about something.
I told you, first of all, I love hanging out with you. Number two, I love this industry. Number three, this is like one of the hottest topics ever. And number four, you're unlocking the code, because the code is. Ooh. Airway, we know airway is a big deal. We know it. 35 years of treatment planning was turned on its head not too long ago for all the teaching institutions. Now it includes a non-negotiable called airway. What good is it if we do all these things, but the patient still can't breathe? We haven't accomplished anything. I think any orthodontist right now would tell you, this is not a small topic. Changing palates and getting kids to breathe is very important to our future. And if you go to any middle school or elementary school and talk to the teachers about some of the challenges that kids have and not being able to focus and think during school.
For sure.
We're on the cusp of something that's very important. And I think the important thing to say here, Mark, is that dentists have the ability to change the world. I don't think there's a lot of medical professionals that understand how important this is. And if you're a dentist and you're in your 30s, you know you have the ability to change people's lives if you understand this concept. So Mark, today we're going to be talking about the treatment. Now, if you're showing up here for the first time and you're in the middle of this, this is part of a series that Mark is doing for us, which we started first with the basic sleep physiology. Then we went into screening. Then we did testing. And today we're going to be talking about treating, and we're going to do these episodes. So if you've missed any of the episodes, just scroll up or scroll down. You're going to see Mark has put all these together, but Mark, give us a little synopsis about what we're going to be talking about today and how important it is.
Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about what arguably is the easiest part of dental sleep medicine, because if we're going to be treating this patient, they've said yes to the treatment, they've already had the sleep test, we screened them in our practice, or they were referred in from somebody else and we screened them. And so we've done what I would call all of the challenging behavioral parts. You know, we've closed them into a sleep test. They've gotten the sleep test back. We've had a consultation. We've closed them into an oral appliance. So now here's the appointment where they're going to be coming in and we're going to be treating them. So now it's like, what are the kinds of things we have to be thinking about to treat this patient effectively and efficiently? And the answer is really easy, because dental sleep medicine clinically is a lot easier to do than most of the other things we do in dentistry. Far easier than preparations, veneers, a lot easier than delivering a bite splint and chasing dots all around the place. So the technical components of the dentistry are so much easier. It's still always tough, because sometimes we don't get a positive result. 75% of the time, we're going to win. 25% of the time, we're going to lose. The patient's not going to be treatable with an oral appliance. We have to try. And we don't give them their money back if it doesn't work. It's a medical procedure. And in medicine, you know, we did the surgery. That didn't work. Now we're going to try radiation. We set the bone. It didn't heal properly. We're going to go back and do it again. You get charged for both of those procedures. So you don't have to worry about that. You get to treat these patients with the best of intentions. and you want to make sure that you have the conversations with them. So maybe that's a little bit of it, that you still want to have a conversation about setting the expectations at 75%, maybe 90% for mild and 80% for moderate and 50% for severe. But the treatment itself, the steps we go through, that part's easy. You're going to like that part. This will be the one too, where dentists, if they're struggling with the conversations, they're going to go, this is the part I like. I'm working in that little 4-inch circle called the mouth.
Yeah, and that's the piece I'm going to really go into today. So I'm going to take the vantage point of a dentist who's listening home. Mark, I got my game card at home. I've been following. I actually listened to the episode on sleep physiology, screening, testing. I'm putting together my notes and my checklist right now. So connect the dots for me from the last episode. Okay, so I've got this test. I now am figuring out how I'm going to do this in my office. I listened to you on what to look for in these results. I've talked to the patient. Take me from the conversation with the patient that you are at risk for this to where do I go next? What's my next step?
So if you mean at risk, that means they still need a test, right? So do you want me to go back through that part of the process?
No, we've already got the test. There's evidence.
So now the patients come back. I've had the consultation with the patient. They've got a positive test result for mild or moderate obstructive sleep apnea. We'll keep this simple. And I say to them, so really, we're ready to get started. The next thing we need to do is to get you in for an appointment where I can do a little bit of an examination, pick some upper and lower models, impressions of your teeth, and then we'll measure your bite relationship and find the right spot to put your jaw so that we can start treating you and see if we can get you to sleep better at night by getting you better air.
Love it.
And the patient says, fantastic, let's go. Once in a while, they say, what does this cost? And we say, well, it's actually covered on your medical insurance, if you recall, like your sleep test was. And they'll go, okay. Once in a while, they ask again, and we say, well, the good news is you have, you know, Kirk, you have Blue Cross insurance or whatever it might be. You have Aetna or Cigna. You have a UAP, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. You have this insurance. And the good news is their maximum allowable procedure for this cost is X number of dollars, $24.56 for Blue Cross. So that's the most that it can cost you out of pocket. Patients hear that as a third party saying it's a fair fee. So we do not get much pushback once the patient's been diagnosed because we've set the stage. We've given them clarity that they're going to move forward. Presumptive close again. Clarity that they're going to move forward because positive test result, but they do have the serious disease. They know it's serious. It's life-threatening. It's a slow killer. It shortens our lifespan. Higher risk for long list of diseases. 23 times more likely to have a heart attack, 4 times more likely to have a stroke, 5 times more likely to die of COVID. We've got all that stuff picked into their brain. So they're like, when can we get started? Most patients don't dwell. See, we're dentists. We dwell on the patient who's focused on the money, or we dwell on this one outlier, and we build systems for that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Build systems for the 80% that are moving forward. Yeah. And just run with those 80% and tell the other 20%, I can't fix you. I can't fix that. That's not my fault.
All right,
that's so how medicine works.
I'm building my system, so I'm listening to you. Now, you know how dentists think. We're talking about prepping crowns. They want to know, okay, wait, what's your burr?
I'll give them a system. I will definitely give them a system.
So tell me about the appointment scheme. So how much time am I doing for that, and what am I going to tell? Is it an hour? Is it an hour and a half? Is it 2 hours? Like, walk me through that.
So I'm gonna start up here high level. So I had a consultation with a patient that was 15 minutes, okay? And now we're going to get started. So I've got 15 minutes invested. They come in for their first appointment. I'm going to do an exam, impressions, and a bite relationship.
Okay.
That will not take an hour. But let's say it takes an hour. Now I'm in an hour and 15 minutes.
Right.
The next appointment, they come back in. I'm going to deliver their device, and I'm going to deliver their morning occlusal guide or morning aligner or whatever you want to call it, or I'll make them a couple. I'll schedule 30 minutes. It will not take 30 minutes, but let's pretend it does.
Right.
Now I'm at an hour 45. They come back 3 weeks later and I give them a pulse oximeter because they think they've got their jaw in the right position. They've been advancing it and we've talked about what to do. And so I have them come in, I give them the pulse oximeter, they drop it back off a couple of days later and I read it and talk to them on the phone again. So that takes 5 minutes. It takes 3 minutes, but let's pretend it takes 15 minutes. It doesn't. If I add all that time up, maybe I've got 2 hours, but you won't. Maybe I've got 2 hours invested in this patient. And I just told you my Blue Cross fee is $24.56. There isn't anything else in your practice that you're billing out at $1,100 and $25 an hour. There just isn't. And so from a productive capability standpoint, that makes great sense. From a saving lives standpoint, it makes great sense. Now you still have to pay your lab bill like you would with Crown and Bridge or anything else like that. But the net on that is going to be one of the most productive things, probably 2.5 to 3 times more productive than the $300 or $400 an hour dentistry that you're generating as a practice. So if we're looking at how much time am I going to invest? Oh, wait a minute, I still got to write up my soap notes. Well, you're paying for some software. I still got to worry about the billing. Oh, no, you have a third-party company that's going to do that. We'll talk about that in the next episode. So what about these soap notes? Well, the software has your assistants ticking off the boxes while you're talking, and it puts together paragraphs and letters all automatically. The software is generating these tremendously cool-looking things that looks like you wrote them each time. A 45-year-old male presented for evaluation of obstructive sleep apnea, paragraphs all from these tick boxes. So 2 hours max.
Okay. I stay with me on these, Chris, because I have to in my brain. Are you pre-appointing all of the appointments, or are you doing them one at a time? So when you say three, you got possibly three appointments, or most likely three appointments.
And you sound like a dentist. You're asking a dentist question here. I love it.
Well, you know how this works. They got to know, like, they need to know, like, all of the, what's the viscosity? Like, where's the research? Mm-hmm. Like, you know how this works.
Totally. So we do. That's what makes us happy. That's what makes us work. So I do not pre-appoint those. So the patient comes in for the first appointment. When they leave from that first appointment, they do not leave without the next appointment. That much is sure. Everybody leaves with an appointment. Good. And so when they're in for their impressions and bite, they leave with their delivery appointment set up. And it's based on the turnaround time. I use mostly ProSomnus devices for obvious reasons. I pay the same everybody else does, by the way. But I use mostly their devices. And they're 7 days manufacturing time. By the time there's a little shipping, it's probably just over 2 weeks. So we usually schedule them 3 weeks out. And then we don't have to keep, just like a Crown would, we'd schedule them 3 weeks out. And then we don't have to keep track of, did the case come back? The case is always back on time. They got tremendous systems for that. So we schedule them 3 weeks later. They come in for that. We do their delivery. We schedule their 3 weeks for the morning occlusal, or for the pulse oximeter. And usually within 3 weeks, they've titrated themselves to the right position. If not, then they still come in. And we usually give them the pulse oximeter. And we talk about what they can do to get to the right position and then use the pulse oximeter and drop it back off. So it's pretty regimented. And then we make them a 6-month follow-up and then a 1-year follow-up.
Okay. All right. And then take me through your kind of your decision tree. You know, when we're talking treatment, like device selection types, like what are some of your protocols for how you?
So I made my first oral appliance 30 years ago, teaching with Keith Thornton at the Pankey Institute. Keith Thornton, his name begins with the letter T, is the T in the TAP appliance. And so he has been a pioneer, a genius, savant, smart guy. He's incredible. It's fun to be around. And he's been truly so innovative in dental sleep medicine. But the first devices we made 30 years ago weren't very pretty. It looked like an upper impression tray that we made, a custom acrylic impression tray with a handle sticking down like this out of the palate. And then on the lower, there was a flat plane, a kind of a horseshoe flat plane, and it was all flat. And this handle would come down and hit on this flat piece. And when you pushed your mandible forward, this thing could drop down behind. So it became this anti-retrusion ramp that came out of the maxilla and landed on the flat line. And until you stuck your jaw forward, you couldn't close. Yeah. Horrible looking. But they kind of worked because we advanced the mandible. We held it in that position. Some people's jaws got jacked up. Their muscles were sore. It reefed on their teeth a little bit. Fast forward to today, that same design, an anterior hook grabbing onto the device, is what the TAP appliance still looks like. And it's still a viable alternative out there on the list of 140 or 150 devices that are FDA approved. So oral appliances are not like bite splints. Bite splints are a class 1 medical device. You can make that in your practice. You can order that up from any dental laboratory. Oral appliances are class 2 medical devices, and they have to be made by an approved type 2 medical device manufacturer. And that can be relicensed. So somebody like Keith Thornton's company can relicense people to make taps. So you'll find dental laboratories that make a tap, or they make other kinds of devices. Some of those devices, they don't actually make. They just send the scans in, the manufacturer makes them, sends them back to the laboratory, and they give them to you. That's okay. That's how it works, because some of those things are pretty high-tech made and things like that.
Right.
At ProSomnus, we make our own devices. So we're direct to dentist, medical device manufacturer, and we don't do other lab work. So we don't make bite splints. We don't make crowns or partials, anything like that. We are strictly a 100% medical device manufacturer. When you think about medical device manufacturing, you think of this crude thing I was talking about. Horrible, horrible. And then somebody got the idea, which was brilliant. We could put like blocks of acrylic on the side and that would hold the appliance together. And so they made these monoblock devices and they would be locked together. So you had an upper and lower and you'd be in it in this forward position. one piece of washer. And it too worked, but jacked around with things. And then somebody got even smarter and they looked over at Ortho and they said, hey, you got all these cool little Herbst arms. You got these cool little jack screws. What if we made an upper and a lower device and we put a block of acrylic on the upper and a block of acrylic on the lower. And on the lower, we attached it to one of these jack screws and we could turn it and I could push something forward. And that was attached to the lower jaw. So I could use the upper jaw as a fixed position and I could push the lower jaw forward with this block of acrylic and a jack screw. Or I could put a Herbst arm on the top and the bottom like this. And so there's this tube and you turn the tube just like a telescoping arm and the telescope pushes the mandible forward. So we took appliances from orthodontics, devices and parts and pieces from orthodontics, and we made them into cooler, adjustable oral appliances. And that was like revolutionary, right? And so now if you said Herbst device, that is the most commonly style of a prescribed device in North America today. Want to know why?
Why?
Of course you do. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. And we, as dentists, sometimes don't know how to get maximum value for things. And so we always gravitate towards the bottom. That's why there's so many monolithic zirconia crowns done today. It's not because they're the most beautiful. It's because they're $95. Right. $85. What? You said I can get them for 75? Give me the name. So, wait, pause this thing.
Yeah.
So Herbst has done quite often. It's inexpensive. Herbst, by the way, is one of the styles that's required by Medicare. Medicare has some funky do rules. We'll talk about that later. So that meets that. So does the tap, by the way. So along comes more technology and somebody says, hey, what if we put a soft liner inside? Would that be easier to wear? Yes, it would. It'd be more comfortable. So now they have a bilaminar material, hard on the outside, soft on the inside. Very comfortable. Beautiful. Or what if we just put some ball clasp here and there for retention? Because sometimes the doctors don't take a perfect impression. If we get a crummy impression, it's going to be hard to get this acrylic to fit, even get hard to get the soft liner to fit. So how about if we just have four ball clasps to fit? Oh, now you fast forward a few years. People have been wearing these new adjustable devices with soft liners and ball clasps. And it turns out they're getting a lot of tooth movement. Because if it only fits where the ball clasps are and the acrylic isn't acting like a retainer and holding them in place, we see an increase in tooth movement. And because we weren't paying attention to getting their bites back in the morning like we should have been, we would worry about it, but we wouldn't really coach those patients that well. We were getting a lot of people with bite changes, and we're getting a lot of people with tooth movement, and the soft liner was gunking up pretty bad, and acrylic gunks up by itself pretty bad. So physicians were looking at these devices, and they're saying, dentists are putting these pieces of stuff in people's mouths, and this is what it looks like, and the patients are complaining about how it looks and smells and tastes. And they're complaining about their bite changes and their teeth movement. So physicians for a long time have not trusted us in dentistry because we don't act very professionally. And it gets worse. All that stuff we talked about, screening, testing, all that. Hey, Kirk, I'll just treat you for your snoring, wink, wink. I won't treat you for sleep apnea. We had dentists who were treating patients without the testing, treating patients without a physician interpreting the results and writing a prescription, patients who were treating their friends and neighbors without proper protocol, without standard operating procedure, without being in the guidelines of medicine that are very strict. And there's a lot of people that were guilty of some of those things. And we did that with the best of intentions because patients would ask us and we'd want to do that. Today, and for the last probably 15 years, 17 years, it's been a lot cleaner. It's been a lot better. And now we've been on a quest to develop better devices because we see all these side effects and all these problems. So now one of the devices that came out that was pretty innovative and very cool was a soft printed nylon. And everybody wants to print and mill today, just like we do with restorative dentistry, print and mill. Very cool. CAD/CAM, very precise, very cool. And so the evolution of a soft liner material came out, which is very comfortable, flexible, drops right in, even more tooth movement. Oh, man, it sucks. Every time we find something we like about this and we trade off one thing for another, we find a new side effect that gets worse. So hard acrylic and soft liner devices have tooth movement. Ball clasp devices have tooth movement. Foregone conclusion. Every study, every case, they always do. Printed nylon devices, which are even more flexible, have even more tooth movement, significantly more than those others. So crap, what do we do? Well, the cool thing is back when I was working for this company that I lecture and teach for now, I'm their lead clinical faculty, whatever that means. They decided to take a pathway to take hard acrylic pucks, which are much denser, easier to keep clean, don't gunk up, and mill them Mill them instead of salt and pepper and try to cure them. Mill them and create an extremely precise platform that would act and fit like a retainer. And now they've got studies with those kinds of devices that don't have any tooth movement. That's pretty cool. No tooth movement is a risk anymore. High five. And then we could talk about spending more time with patients getting their bite back in the morning. And that company can also make not just those pucks for the appliance, but from those pucks of hard acrylic, they can make little frames that fit over the front teeth that guide your jaw back to its position called morning occlusal guides. So now we can have a precision manufacturing way to make devices that are more precise, no tooth movement, easier to keep clean. Because they're made out of this hard puck of acrylic, they're smaller. You can take out a lot of the acrylic on the inside and make them lingualess. That's cool because wasn't I pulling the mandible forward to open the airway?
Right.
And if I pull the mandible forward and the tongue still has all this acrylic in there, I have to pull the mandible farther forward to open the airway. But if there's less acrylic on the inside because the device and the material is smaller, I don't have to pull the mandible as far forward. I'll have fewer temporomandibular joint side effects, which we were also getting with any of those kinds of devices. So I'm not jacking up the jaws as much because I don't have to go as far forward. High five. I don't get any tooth movement. High five. I can make a device that helps them get their bite back in the morning. High five. And they don't gunk up and look like crap. So now we're starting to earn a little bit of respect in the medical community for using medical devices that are made with a higher level of accuracy, a higher level of precision, easy to clean, less side effects, less toxic reactions, things like that. So it's been a tremendous evolution from handmade, borrowed from other aspects of dentistry, designed by dentists, made by dentists, to now something that has been designed by engineers.
Yeah.
And now they use artificial intelligence and robotic manufacturing to make these things, and they're awesome.
Okay,
really fun.
I got to ask you, because we're going to dig deeper into the treatment, but I want to pause here and ask you this question, because we talked about the effectiveness of the testing. That's changed a lot. Let's talk about, you mentioned research. Talk about the effectiveness of these devices. Like, how much more effective are they as I go down
this question. So let's go back 20 years and look in the literature at the efficacy, and let's define some terms. Efficacy, how well a product, a policy, a chemical or something works under ideal conditions. Efficacy, what's the potential solution that this medicine treatment can provide?
Yes.
Then we talk about something like effectiveness. Well, wait a minute, why wouldn't those be the same? Well, because if I gave you a pill that lowered your cholesterol and it did a great job of lowering your cholesterol, but it made your hair fall out. Now, that's not a good example with you, Kurt. But let's say it made your eyebrows fall out. All right. You might say, I'm not taking that pill. So your compliance was poor.
Right.
The efficacy of that anti-cholesterol medication that I wanted to give you was very good. Works 100% of the time. But some people don't take it because their eyebrows fall out. And so maybe only half the people take it. So if I took efficacy at 100% times compliance, 50%, the drug's only 50% effective in a population of people. So when you use the term effectiveness, and I know you know this, you were choosing the right term, not efficacy, because CPAP is almost 100% efficacious. It works almost 100% of the time. It has side effects too, by the way, but it works almost 100% of the time. Great, let's just use CPAP. Oh no, why not? Because it's not very effective. What do you mean? Efficacy, effective? Well, at the end of 1 year, most studies will tell you that the average CPAP patient is only wearing their CPAP 40% of the time. This gets worse. What do you mean wearing it? Define wearing it. 8 hours a night? 7 nights a week? Oh, no. In the CPAP world, they define compliance or adherence as 4.5 hours per night, 5 nights out of 7. So wait a minute. Works 100% of the time, worn 40% of the time for about half the time. So if I do 100% times 40% times half the time, I'm maybe about 20% effectiveness.
Love that.
Now, they won't let us take that last calculation I did. So in the medical literature, they say, no. Adherence is 4.5 hours a night. Okay. So it's 100 times 40%. It's 40 to 50% effective. I don't think so. But that's what they would argue. Oh, and then they fell on the sword. They fell on the sword themselves. They did a study in the New England Journal of Medicine called the SAVE trial, 2,600 patients. They followed these patients for, ready, 7 years, 84 months, 84 months. They followed these patients and they said, all right, we're going to measure how many of these patients, 2,600 and change, we're going to give half of them a CPAP, half of them no treatment at all. They all have moderate or severe obstructive sleep apnea. And we're going to do a randomized controlled trial. That's the best kind of study to do, randomized. You get CPAP, you get nothing. You get CPAP, you get nothing. You get CPAP, you get nothing for 2,600 patients. Then we're going to sit back and watch you for 7 years. And we're going to measure the number of cardiovascular events in those two populations over time. And we're going to see how effective CPAP is. 7 years, New England Journal of Medicine, no difference between the two populations.
You're kidding.
No, it's sick. It's sick. It's called the SAVE trial by McAvoy. You can look it up. It'll be on the slides that, go along with this lecture, with this podcast. So what happened was some of those patients wore the CPAP every single night, 7 or 8 hours a night. And those patients for sure had a lower cardiovascular incidence. But in a population of 1,350 patients or so, most of them were wearing it, not at all. Some of them were wearing it 40% of the time, 4.5 hours a night. And how much effect did it have on reducing the disease? None statistically. Were there patients in the study that it helped? Of course there were. But as a population, as a therapeutic design for a study, no statistical difference between the two populations. That's horrible. And so that flipped them on their ear. That was 2016. So that's 5 years ago. So the McAvoy study, the SAVE trial, was very influential for people to take a new look at other therapeutics that we could use for obstructive sleep apnea. So oral appliances moved up a notch, okay? Now you've seen the development of things like Inspire, where they surgically implant a pacemaker-like thing in your chest, run some wires up your neck to your glossal muscles, and keep a little muscle tone while you're sleeping. It's not, they make it look on TV like, hey, I press the button, no mask, no hose, just sleep. Well, they do a surgical procedure and implant this thing and run wires up your neck. That's pretty invasive to me, and it's $50,000 or $60,000. It works for a select group of people with certain types of obstructive sleep apnea.
Right.
So they've been making CPAP smaller, quieter, cleaner, everything. Masks better fitting. They've been doing all kinds of things, and still compliance stays like crap. So how effective is oral appliance therapy? 20 years ago, it was around 50% effective at treating all cases of sleep apnea. Today, it's approaching 70% when you look at all the devices.
Wow.
That's looking at the literature, at the studies. So making better devices instead of these crude ones like I was making, and now moving into this CAD/CAM, robotic manufacturing, artificial intelligence, the things we do with extruding anatomy, prosthetics, making these devices more comfortable, smaller, a little bit of flexibility, super cool stuff. It's kind of science fiction-y when you look at how we do it. But at the end of the day, it's increasing the compliance. Oh, no. People were always kind of willing to wear oral appliances over CPAP. It's really improving the compliance some, but it's really improving the efficacy. So today, when we've looked back, and there's a couple of abstracts that are published right now with the ADSM and AASM, that's the dental and the medical groups. Eddie Sutton, a physician out of Syracuse, New York, and I have worked on a couple of efficacy articles. We worked on some things looking at this novel device that's out, this Evo, this new appliance that's out. And we're seeing overall, instead of 50%, we're seeing between 74 and 76% efficacy. That's fantastic. If you just say mild and moderate, it's around 89% efficacy. That's incredible. So severes were about 50-50, so we pushed those people back to CPAP, but mild and moderates were about 89%, and average compliance is 7 hours a night, 7 nights a week, and we get in the 90s for that, mid-90s for compliance or adherence. And you, people used to say, well, you're lying about that. That's just what people are reporting. Well, now they can put little chips in the devices, and they can measure whether or not the patient is actually wearing it and how much. So we've actually got confirmation of the kinds of compliance. So now, remember the math we did on a CPAP, 100%. Times 40%, maybe cut in half. Oral appliances, let's say they're 75%. Let's say they're 70%, we'll make the math easy. And let's say they're worn 90% of the time. That's 60%+ effectiveness versus maybe 30% or 40% effectiveness. So we're going to see a shift as we make better devices, as we make more precise devices, cleaner devices, we're going to earn physicians' trust. And they control a massive amount of prescription writing, $4.5 billion, versus maybe a couple hundred million worth of oral appliances are done every year. So we're going to see a shift in their prescribing patterns. We'll see more and more oral appliances. Some of the Scandinavian countries, if you recall from one of the earlier sessions, 50%, 60% in some of those countries, oral appliance first, CPAP second. So huge shift. So oral appliances, effectiveness, great, great term that you used.
Yeah. So I was just curious about that. And I think I'm going to get an exponential return. I mean, data doesn't lie. The second analogy that you're presenting is I can get my brain, because I'm a dentist, I need the data, I need the research to be able to prove that. And then also the remote capabilities of these things. I mean, you can titrate a patient from a remote, you know, in a remote way, and you can see, you get real-time data now. You can see what's happening.
Yep. It is
so anecdotal. Yep. In that respect. So now let's go back to the path on treatment. So as far as the steps go, when you look at the exam, what we're going to do, discussing, like anything that we left out on all of these steps, all the way down to device selection and types.
So let me, as you're suggesting, jump up a couple thousand feet for a second. So the treatment is going to be, we're going to need to do an exam. Now, if it's already your patient, then you may already have all of the exam data you need. But you want to make sure that that patient is capable of wearing an oral appliance. You want to document their temporomandibular health, because we are going to pull their mandible down and forward. And most of the time, we're going to make TMJ patients better, TMD patients better. But you still want to document that. Do they have any clicking or pain, sore muscles on palpation? So I want a snapshot. How many teeth the patient has, where facets, where their teeth fit together, do they touch in the back? I want a snapshot of them before treatment. And then I can always compare that after treatment to see, did something I do change something, if that was a problem or not? So we take that snapshot. So if somebody doesn't have enough teeth, has incredible mobility, you know, they might not be a candidate for oral appliance therapy. I'm holding the hands of these new doctors who are getting into sleep all the time. It's part of my job with ProSomnus, and I love doing it because I love to teach. But they'll say to me, well, this patient only has this many teeth and they're really mobile. What do I do? Well, you probably don't make an oral appliance. You probably tell them they have to have CPAP. Sorry, we can't fix everything. I can't fix that. I don't have a solution. Oral appliance therapy has some requirements, and that patient might not meet the requirements. But your exam is really not, when I do an exam on a patient, I don't have any of my own patients to screen. So I get patients from other dentists and from physicians. So when I screen a patient that's not my patient, I have to be able to document that they're capable of wearing an oral appliance. So I'm not really doing a dental exam. I'm never going to be their dentist. I don't do that anymore. But I do want to make sure that they've got enough teeth, enough comfort, enough stability to wear an appliance. So that's what the exam is for. That might or might not include radiographs, depending on your purveyance of what you want to know, what you need to know. Imagery is always important if you need to know more. I like an image of their midlines, so I can make sure that the midline I record and the midline they have are similar. So we do that. After the exam, I'm going to need an impression of their upper and lower teeth. Now, if I'm going to make a can I say shitty? I think I just did.
Say whatever you want.
If I make a shitty device, then I can take a shitty impression and they can make it with ball class or a soft liner and make it flexible enough to fit.
Yeah.
But then I have all those side effects to worry about. So there's a trade-off. There's a trade-off. But if I give an excellent impression to a laboratory like ProSomnus, to a manufacturer like ProSomnus, they can make a precision device where teeth don't move. But in order to do that, they can't have an average impression. They got to have a great impression. So not alginate, not silginate. There are some people who could take a great alginate. There are. And there's some people that could take a great silginate impression. There are. But really, the protocol we recommend for analog impressions is the same you would use for Invisalign. It's a putty with a piece of separating material over it, like Saran wrap. And then that completely sets in the mouth. You take it out, remove the Saran wrap, squirt in light body, and go back in with the light body wash. Those impressions, magnifique. Très bien. They're fantastic. And there's so much detail there that we can make a precision device that fits in beautifully, has excellent retention, doesn't need any accessory things for retention, and fits like a retainer. So if we're willing to invest a few more minutes up front, we can use a device that's more accurate and prevents side effects down the road, prevents intervention, less breakage, all of that kind of stuff down the road. So it will pay dividends down the road to invest those few extra minutes in taking a better impression. If I'm scanning, we scan now. We don't take analog impressions. When I took analog impressions, I did every single one of them just like I described. Putty wash, putty wash, putty wash, every time. Now I scan. I've got a Medit scanner, and we go in there, and in a minute and a half or so, a little faster than it used to be with the other technique, it's kind of cool. We scan the upper, we scan the lower, high five, we scan the bite, all good. That gets sent off digitally. I like scanning for a couple of reasons. Patients think it's super cool. It's probably a little faster than regular impressions. I think in the long run, it'll prove out less expensive because I'm doing full arch impressions. I'm not sure that that always works out beautifully when it's quadrant impressions or triple trays or dual arch trays, but about 23 or 24% of the dentists today have scanning capabilities in their practices. It's been a slow adoption, even though we were talking earlier about Sirona and Dentsply and their 27 and a half and their 30 meeting. Now it should be 35, I guess. And that's 30 years to get to 25%. That's crazy. At ProSomnus, 82% of all the cases that come into us are digital.
The Best Practices Show with Kirk Behrendt is brought to you exclusively by ACT Dental, the ultimate provider of dental practice management solutions for dentists and their teams. ACT Dental is committed to helping you build a better practice and a better life. If you're looking to grow your production, motivate your team, get back on track, and create the practice you've always dreamed about, look no further. Give us a call at 800-851-8186 or visit us at actdental.com.
See, that blows my mind because I got my start here in Milwaukee in a lab. I remember the volume polysiloxane and tray. I remember the lab tech screaming, "You're kidding. I got to make teeth out of this." Now, anyone that's made the traverse over to digital is like, well, that's a no-brainer because the accuracy is scary. Now, I would say this.
So good.
Sometimes dentists get in their own heads, but as a patient who has been through and is currently in Invisalign, just go do yourself a favor. Go get an impression from a dentist you respect. Just ask yourself, how's this working out? Like, how's this feel?
And then get scanned.
And just go, you know, I don't know. Like, was there, like, from a patient perspective, which one did I enjoy and which one? I don't know. Like, I got one experience here and I want to just compare the two. And if you can't see the benefit of the second one, you're just, there's something not working totally here, you know?
And you know, Kirk, not to get on a tangent on scanners, not my point here, but when scanners first came out, they were very expensive.
Right.
And then like everything else that came down, they didn't. I don't get it. Scanners have stayed super expensive. They're $30,000 or $40,000.
Right.
We have a Medit scanner. I mentioned Medit. It's a Korean company that came out. They've got a very capable scanner. And it's not even $20,000. It's around $14,000 or $15,000 through most of the suppliers. So I'm not trying to sell a scanner one over another, but today the cost of the hard costs of a scanner have come down so much that I think it's going to make a more cost-effective decision for somebody to move from analog impressions to scanning. Dentists who do dental sleep medicine have made that switch like that because a full arch upper and lower impression costs about $45. $45. Not a little triple tray for one crown and a couple teeth. $45. And that's not counting the time.
And let's not, you're not even counting the training on that. You just don't hand that to an assistant and say, go at it. Like, they got to know how to do that really well, right?
Absolutely. So a $45 impression, that's a comparable, that's a big deal. If I'm taking a putty wash for dental sleep medicine, it's 2.5 minutes to set to maybe 3 minutes to be safe. So 3 minutes, then 3 minutes of light body, that's 6. Then you do the same on the bottom, that's 12. Then you take the bite, so 13, 14. Let's say 15 minutes of hard time to take the impression. I can scan an upper. We actually shot a video of scanning, and I was scanning my wife's mouth, which I scanned several times, and I usually scan it faster than I did in the video. I don't know why, but it's just like I got tangled up, I think. Not because I was on camera. That didn't bother me. I just got tangled up that time. I scanned her upper or lower and took the bite in 3 minutes and 49 seconds.
Wow.
3 minutes and 49 seconds. Now, I'm pretty good at it, and I've scanned her mouth before, but I have scanned it faster. But say 4 minutes instead of 16 minutes. Now, I'm not looking to save 8 minutes. Maybe I am, because if I saved 8 minutes a day, at the end of 5 days, that'd be 40 minutes. At the end of a month, that'd be a couple of hours. Maybe I can make my kid's soccer game, or maybe I could schedule another crown prep or two, or maybe I could get out of work earlier, take another vacation. So I would have choices to make with my time, wouldn't I? That's what you do as a consultant. And you find ways to become more efficient.
Well, you know this, the smartest people in dentistry, they get the time thing figured out. It's the value of your time that you, and now the other thing is this would be a fun we won't do this here, but we could do the efficacy effectiveness on analog and digital impressions and actually do a time study. Like, okay, we'd have split screens going and compare the, what actually happened. Now we're going to go down a rabbit hole, but I'm
so told- all right. So let me finish these steps. So we take an impression, then we take a bite. Then the patient goes away. They come back in 3 weeks.
Okay.
When they come back in 3 weeks, we deliver their device, make sure everything's comfy. We show them how to adjust it going forward, depending on the type of device. And then we send them away again. And we show them how to get their bite back in the morning with a little device, a little MOG. We send them away again. They come back in 3 weeks and we put a pulse oximeter on their finger. They've advanced their mandible. They found a spot that they like that they say they sleep better at. That's a subjective improvement in symptoms. And now I want some objective data on their finger with a pulse oximeter. If that's good and matches their subjective symptoms, then I send them for the follow-up sleep test. And delivering these devices, I mean, you put the upper in, they go, how's that feel? They go, feels kind of tight, doesn't it? I go, yep. Is it pinching or cutting anywhere? I go, nope. Put the lower in. How's that feel? Does it feel tight? Yep. Pinching or cutting anywhere? Nope. Feel like it bites evenly? Yep. Okay. I just delivered 15 of this newest device from Prosomnus to Evo, 15 in a row, no adjustments, delivered. I didn't put any of them in the patient's mouth. They all put them in their own mouth. That's how easy these new devices are, these new precision devices are to deliver. First time fits, they drop right in, no adjustments. If they need an adjustment, I would figure I screwed something up, I'd start over.
Yeah.
They just don't need it. It's magic the way this stuff works, especially with scanning, doing all this stuff, such accuracy. It's great.
Yeah. You want to get them started on that. Now the follow-up testing, give me a little perspective on the time and what you're looking for in the follow-up test.
So I'd love to just give you the quick answer to say a reduction in the AHI score, but that's only one part of what I'm trying to achieve. So Covey says, begin with the end in mind, right? We've all read those books.
Right.
So when I'm starting with a patient and I'm sitting there and we're in consultation, I start to set up in my discussion, just like I was talking about setting up these presumptive closes, moving forward. I also start to talk about what we're hoping to achieve. And I talk to them that 75% of the time, 90% in milds, 80% in moderates, 50% of the time in severes, I'm setting up their expectations. And I tell them we're really looking for four things when we talk about successful treatment of a patient.
Okay.
Four things. The first thing is I want a reduction in the number of times you don't breathe well at night so that you get better oxygen. I want their AHI score to come down, right? I want it to come down below 5, or I'd like it to be below 10 plus a 50% improvement, not or, plus. And so when you hear my efficacy data, that's either getting somebody below 5 or getting somebody below 10 and a 50% improvement. And we use that because if somebody's a 60 and you get them down to a 9, that's a fantastic result, okay? But they're still a 9 and not below 5. They're not in the normal range, but every physician would tell me, great job, okay? On the other hand, if you got a 50% reduction and you went from 62 to 31, the patient might be sleeping better and feeling better, but they still have severe obstructive sleep apnea, 31 times an hour. That's an unacceptable result. So we really need below 5, comma, or below 10 and a 50% reduction. Because if somebody was 11 and you got them to 9, that's not very good. Right. But if you got them from 11 to 5, they're not below 5, but that would be an acceptable result. So there's those two math equations and they work together. So I want the AHI score to come down. That's one. The second thing, I want a reduction of the patient's subjective symptoms. They snore. Now they don't. They peed 4 times a night. Now it's 1. They felt tired in the morning and unrefreshed. They were tired during the day. They feel better now. That's an improvement in the patient's subjective symptoms. That's almost as important as the AHI score. If you got the score down and the patient still felt like shit, I can't call that a win.
Right.
So you got to have both components. They've got to feel better. And maybe you couldn't get them to stop snoring, but they sleep better and they feel better. Or maybe they stop snoring, but they still don't feel as refreshed in the morning and the AHI score is down. There's an improvement in their subjective symptoms. It might not be perfect, but there's an improvement. You're moving the needle in the right direction. The third thing I want is no side effects. See, if I get those successful results, but their jaws hurt, their teeth moved, their bite changed, that's not a win either. Because now they're living with some toxic impact from the drug I gave them, the dose I gave them. We talked about dose management and obstructive sleep apnea. I've got an abstract that's published right now with the American Academy of Dental Sleep Medicine on dose, their minimum therapeutic dose in obstructive sleep apnea. We don't talk about, it's like a drug dose, but it is. How much do we advance them? Well, if I'm using better devices, I don't have to go as far. I'll have fewer side effects. If I use better devices, I don't get as much tooth movement. So I can minimize my side effects through better device selection. So I've got an HI score that's come down. Subjective symptoms have got better. They don't have any side effects. High five. The final thing, I want excellent compliance.
Okay.
The treatment only works if they wear it every night. And you can't do what people do with CPAP. Remember, we talked about 4.5 hours a night, right? Why is that? Well, because people go to bed, and while they're awake, they're diligent about putting their mask on, and they fall asleep.
Right.
And they fall asleep at 9 o'clock, and at 12:30, they had to get up to go pee. They take their mask off to go pee. They don't put it back on when they go back to bed.
Okay. I got to
ask.
Oh, go ahead.
One more thing. Here's the worst part about that. First part of the night, if you remember our discussions, more deep sleep. Second part of the night, more REM sleep. Yes. Uh-oh. REM sleep, usually a higher AHI score. So we learned efficacy. We learned compliance. We learned effectiveness. You could say mean disease alleviation for effectiveness. Now we could talk about what's their AHI score after treatment. Zero the first part of the night, but very high the second part of the night. Combine that, and we could talk about what's called the SARA index in medicine, the sleep-adjusted residual AHI score. Sleep-adjusted residual AHI score. They wore the CPAP 4.5 hours a night. Okay. The other 3.5 hours, they had a score of 60 per hour. We average that out. They still have an AHI of 22.5 or something like that.
Okay.
It's just math. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. Now, let me just be devil's advocate. I'm a patient. You're treating. We're checking the boxes. I love your four. We're looking for four indicators. Is this a weighted score? Are there things, let's say we get through 1, 2, but like 3 and 4 aren't working for me. Take me through your thought processes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So each box is going to be looked at separately. The AHI score, we have to get a therapeutic enough result to warrant continuation of treatment. Now, let me explain that. If you started with a score of 64 and I got you down to 32, you're not treated. You're still going to die prematurely. You still have severe sleep apnea. And I can't in good conscience think that you're going to be comfortable being in treatment. I need to push you back towards CPAP. What happens if you won't wear CPAP? You won't. You refuse. And you won't get surgery done. Then that might be the best therapeutic outcome for you. So I might be able to check that box. And the physician might be able to say, well, if the patient won't do this and this and this, I can't fix that. This is as good as we're able. Then that box could still get checked. We would never include you in the therapeutic results. When I say 75%, you're in the 25 still. But that might be the best appropriate treatment for you. Subjective symptoms. Ooh, that's a gray scale. That one's easy. That's gray. I'd like to take all of your subjective symptoms away. Sometimes I say to the patient, so you snore, you feel like crap the next day, you wake up multiple times a night. If we could just fix one of those things, which would be most important? I'm trying to hang my hat on one, right? Sometimes I ask that question, but really I tell them, I hope to be able to improve all of those symptoms, but sometimes we don't. Sometimes we get your score down and you still snore. Sometimes you get your score down and you still get up and go pee a couple times. But as long as we make an improvement in that, we're moving in the right direction, I'll feel good. So improvement.
Right.
If you peed 4 times a night, now it's 2, that's good. If you snored loudly and now you snore a little, that's good. So they're all gray. That's an easy grayscale improvement. Well, no side effects. How about this? To check the box, it has to be no side effects, comma, that cause the discontinuation of treatment. If your jaw's hurt or your teeth hurt, and therefore you won't wear the device, it's not successful treatment. But if you say, I just had a patient with dementia who reports to her husband, who then reports to me, she says she wakes up in the morning and her teeth feel kind of sore in her mouth a little bit, but she doesn't complain about it all during the day. I go, she only complains about it when she takes the device out? Yeah. And she puts the device back in the next day? Yeah. We're good. That's a perfectly acceptable minimal side effect. I take the medication and it lowers my cholesterol, but it does upset my stomach a little bit. So I try to take it with food, but usually in the morning after I take that, I've got a little bit of a stomach upset, but it's not horrible.
Right.
Okay. I can live with that. So how bad is the toxic effect? How bad is the side effect? As long as it's minimal and small, and I've got some graphs I use with this in some lectures, which are kind of cool. There's a minimum therapeutic dose. When we exceed that, or to get to that dose, we get a toxic effect. There's mild, moderate, and death-causing. So we don't want any of those. So I don't want the side effects to cause discontinuation of treatment. The final one, 7 hours, seven nights. That's the one we kind of hang our hat on in dental sleep medicine. We should hang our hat on 4.5 hours a night, seven nights a week or five nights a week, like medicine does. I have seen in the literature 6 hours, seven nights. I've seen that. I'm okay with that. But the idea is then I have to start doing a calculation about the sleep adjusted residual AHI score again. I want that to be the same as their AHI score. I want a patient to wear that the whole night while they're sleeping. I'd like them to also wear it, for example, when they take a nap in the afternoon or anything else like that. That's not necessarily realistic for everybody to do that, but that would be my goal. If you're sleeping, you have this appliance in and your airway's patent. So I need a lower score to be successful, an improvement of some degree in the subjective symptoms, for sure. I'm okay with side effects as long as they don't cause you to stop wearing the device. And then finally, I would kind of hang my hat on almost all of the night, seven nights a week, 7 hours, seven nights.
Awesome. Awesome. I love it.
And if you wear it every night and you have no side effects and you're sleeping better, but your score is high, that's not successful. Right. So some of them are mutually excludable.
Yeah. Gosh, so many good thought processes on here. Anything else?
Yeah, it's actually really simple. It's so much simpler than a lot of other things, but man, that's why it's so tough. 75%. Right. You know, I would tell you probably 95% of my patients have a subjective improvement in how they sleep with an oral appliance.
Right.
I don't really know the exact number. I don't ask the questions that way, but I'll bet it's 95%. But only 75% have a low AHI score too to go with.
Right. Now, again, you and I have never talked about this, but I'm a dentist listening to this. I'm thinking that if I come in and you improve my life a little bit, you give me the breadcrumb. We're talking slice. Eventually, I'm going to be talking loaf with you, like Bob Barkley, who was brilliant, way ahead of his time. Always said something like this, and I'm going to totally screw this up. The more you got them periodontally healthy, the more they wanted what you really did, which was the restorative piece. You know, do you find that's true in dental sleep medicine? We might start here, but then we're going to be talking about other things eventually that would improve their overall oral health. Is that true or not true?
Yeah, Kirk, that's a great question. And I'd be the wrong person to answer that, to be honest. I'd love to be able to give you an honest answer. I can tell you what I would guess. I would think that it's a natural transition from airway health to airway restorative dentistry and airway prosthodontics and general dental health. I would think that's a natural transition. I do try to encourage patients, because none of these patients are ever going to get treated dentally by me. I don't do any of that. I haven't for a long time. So I'm going to treat them for their airway and then I send them back. But I do always encourage them because some of them have restorative needs. So I'm still encouraging them to get the restorative dentistry done, get the treatment done, sometimes to phase what we're doing, what they're doing. So I do think that improves their awareness. I do, but I think if I were practicing dentistry and I were practicing airway in the same practice, I would feel pretty comfortable that they would go hand in hand and work together. I know that like the folks out at Spear do a really nice job with airway-centric prosthodontics, that whole concept. I love that thinking. I think that's the right pathway to be on. If you're going to spend $30,000 or $40,000, $50,000 with me, and you're going to do implants and overdenture and all this kind of crap like that, we're not just going to stick them where your jaw is. We should think about where your jaw should be from an airway patency standpoint, because most of us are going to have a constricted airway. And a lot of the people that have had a lot of breakdown might be people who were constrained for space in the first place. So while we're doing all that restorative care, why don't we think about where's the airway fit into this? So I think they would go together, but that's not something I get a chance to experience.
Right. And be patient with
good questions.
Yeah. Be patient with me with that questions, because I'm thinking like a dentist now. Okay. Mark, I'm totally in. Okay. But I'm a dentist. I work 4 days a week. I got a lot of PPO. I do a lot of bread and butter, crown and bridge. Help me understand. I'm not going to sprinkle this everywhere in my practice. Are you going to suggest like I have, you know, certain time slots to do this? And then the other thing I'm trying to think up logistically, what do I equip my office with? Like, help me understand in a typical work week, what adjustments am I going to make to my schedule or to the setup? Yeah. Anything that come to mind?
Yeah. So the first thing is that if you're super busy and making tons of money and you're running around crazy and you love your life, just screen them and refer them to somebody else. That's the first thing I'd say. If you say to yourself, no, Mark, I'm working with ACT Dental Consulting, and I'm trying to find a way to get away from some of these PPOs. And one of the ways is to have better patients who value dentistry more. But hey, one of the other ways that I can get away from all this PPO reimbursement stuff that's beaten me to death, because I'm doing two crowns to make the same money I make on one crown for a patient that's not a PPO. You know the math. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. These are your words. I'm just throwing them back at you. That's what you teach folks so well. So what if I could do a half day a week of airway? What if I could do a half day a week of dental sleep medicine? Would that free me up to be able to say goodbye to some of these PPOs and have less risk economically for doing that? Yeah, I think that's a great way to leverage that. What I would do is I would not sprinkle this in the week. And I know that's what you were meaning when you said, would you sprinkle it in the week? Of course you wouldn't. I would segregate an hour or 2 hours or a half day or whatever it took. And I would do one thing. I would dress differently. I would talk differently. I would act differently. I would process the patients differently. I would want that patient to think, I'm in the same building, but this doesn't feel like I'm in Dr. Mark Murphy, the dentist's office anymore. This feels like a medical practice. And if I wore scrubs, I would wear a shirt and a tie and a lab coat that day. That half day, I would dress differently. I would talk differently. We would process the patient differently. Why? Because I want to help them start to be open to the moments of impact that I want them to have that we talked about the last few sessions. I want them to have a physical plant that says, this looks and feels a little different. And I didn't sit them in a dental chair to have the conversation. I sat across from them in a consultative kind of room, because this isn't a dental kind of appointment. It's more of a medical appointment. We're talking. It's a consultation about risk. We've screened them. I want to close them into a sleep test. They don't need to be in a dental chair to do that. I want everything to feel as different as it can. I need to set up systems, though, so that I have the software, I have the billing, which we'll talk about next, and that I have, maybe it's an iPad, and my daughter, Kim, who works for me, runs my sleep practice, she's taking the notes and doing everything, so that that flows smoothly, that the language is right, that we talk about medical billing, that we're assistive of that patient process. But I want to segregate that out. But what a beautiful way. Just think quick math. If I did one case a week, four cases a month, that's $120,000 ballpark of revenue. $120,000. Let's call it $100,000. If I've got a typical $750,000 or $800,000 collection practice, and I took $100,000 of that $750,000 or $800,000, that's 12.5% shift in my revenue stream at a much higher margin. I'm talking business now. Now I look over at this PPO and I've looked at my seven or eight different PPOs I'm signed up for, and these three suck. And the other ones are just bad, but these three suck. Now I can write letters to these patients and start to talk about, I can't be their dentist anymore at these fees. I'd love to have you stay and pay the full fee and get reimbursed whatever you can, but I just can't take that kind of, I can't do a crown that's $1,200 and get $600 or $700 for it. And you and I both seen practices that do that.
Yeah.
So what a great tool to create the kind of change or to decrease the risk for the kind of change that you want to take on.
Dude, this is so brilliant. Sure. I've never heard it described that way. And you're right. That is an incredible opportunity. So if you're a young dentist and this is important to you long-term, what a great way to rethink the next three decades. You know what I mean? Just rethink.
So for a young dentist, what a great way to rethink the next three decades. For a dentist that is getting up in years and starting to think about their transition plan, you're sitting in a practice and you say to yourself, I've got this $800,000 a year practice and I want to sell it. So I want to bring somebody in and grow it. Fantastic. When you bring somebody in, what part of the $800,000 are you going to give them right now? So you better grow that $800,000 to $1 million, bring them in to do $200,000. That's not very exciting. So what do you do? Well, if I add sleep and I find that I can be very profitable one day a week during sleep, and I grow this from $800,000 to $1 million, maybe I can bring them in and give them $400,000, and I still make the same net on my part that I made before. And now I've got this young associate in, and she's working towards becoming a partner and owning the practice. And then I sell them the either half the dental practice, like that's a great model. I've loved that from back in the Mercer days and all. I was familiar with that. I'm sure you've seen practices go half and half again and half again. Or maybe I sell the whole practice to her. That's fine. And then I stay a couple days awake doing sleep, whatever that is. But now that helps me grow the practice, because I'm like, I don't want to work as hard as I'm working 4 days a week. I don't want to work that hard 6 days a week just to grow this practice so I can bring an associate in and have it make sense. But growing sleep is another, I mean, I don't want to think about sleep. Our conversation isn't really about the practice management of using sleep as a transition tool, or the practice management of using sleep as getting rid of your PPOs or going down PAR tool. But it absolutely is that. It absolutely can be that tool.
For sure. That's brilliant. And what we're really talking about is you're helping us through the series decode it all. And those are pieces that have to be decoded. And everybody's future is different, but that is a brilliant, brilliant way to think given all those different scenarios. Mark, that's genius. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, next, we're going to be talking in the next podcast, we're going to be talking about the billing. Any last thoughts about treatment when it comes to this important component?
Yeah, and I've said it before, but I'm going to say it one more time. The treatment is physically and mentally the easiest part of this process. And taking a quality impression is something we all can do. Delivering an upper and lower splint they're going to mate together is something we can all do. Giving somebody a pulse oximeter, these are all very simple things to do. It's the stuff that leads up to this and then the billing and documentation afterwards that really require dodging, you know, the minefield and coming out surviving on the other side with full compensation that becomes important. The doing part is actually, that's in our wheelhouse. We're good at that. So don't fear learning that part. When you take a sleep course, a broader sleep course, that's where they'll spend most of their time, is in the treatment area. And that's great. And that's why a lot of docs walk out of those programs and go, holy crap, this isn't as easy as they said. It's because these lead in and the payment out part are where you get stuck. So treatment, that's pretty easy.
Yeah, buddy, I love this. And again, if you're listening to this, you know, I'm going to encourage you, if you haven't listened to the episode where he explains sleep physiology, and then he has another episode in which we talk about screening and then testing. And then after this, we're going to do billing and documentation. I'm going to encourage you to check that out. Now, Mark, again, just like I said in the last episode, let's say I'm a dentist, which I'm doing right now, I'm picking up what you're putting down, and I want to get started on this, or I just need to know a little bit more. How do I get a hold of you? What do you do? Where do I start?
You know, in my role with ProSomnus Sleep Technologies, I'm the lead faculty. My job is to help dentists who are getting started in sleep get more successful at sleep. ProSomnus is smart. They know that if a dentist is working with them and they get busier, they get to sell more devices. So I love being in that role. I love getting to teach and help people be more successful. They're welcome to email me. They can scroll down. You'll see my contact information there. They can just click on that and it'll open up an email, which will be fine. You can reach out to me. I'm happy to help. If you need guidance, we're going to talk about it in the next section. Where can I get more education? What kind of association should I join? What kind of softwares, companies do I talk to? We're going to talk about all that stuff in the billing and documentation section. So hang on for that one. If you want a little bit more guidance in those arenas, we'll be back with that on the next episode.
All right. There he is. Check it out. Reach out to Murph. You're going to love him as much as I do. He's been a great hero, mentor of mine. You'll enjoy him. It'll change your life. It's just awesome. So, buddy, I can't thank you enough, brother. This is awesome. So if you're listening to this and you enjoyed it as much as we did, just do us a favor. Hit the share button. Share it with your friends. Tell everybody, because this will not only change their practice, but it'll change people's lives. Check out Mark's great company. Reach out to Mark. And until we see you guys next time, or you listen to us next time, keep watching the Best Practices Show. You guys enjoy the rest of your day.
There you have it. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Best Practices Show. I hope you sure did enjoy it. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us. We are always here for you. And if you haven't done so already, make sure you subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you consume podcasts. And if you really enjoy it, you can leave a comment or a 4 or 5 star review. But until we see you next time, keep watching the Best Practices Show.